Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the sound. It's John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Thanks for tuning into our award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Are you ALICE? ALICE is the United Way's acronym for Asset Limited, Income Constrained, and Employed. Too many Connecticut households are in an ALICE situation, with 6 out of 10 affected households living on a bare-bones survival budget that covers just the essentials: food, housing, childcare, transportation, and health care. But the 2016 Connecticut ALICE report revealed that nearly 4 out of 10 Connecticut households can't even afford that frugal budget. So we'll take a brief look at the latest ALICE report, the consequences of insufficient household income, to learn about the ripple effects that result when households don't earn enough to make ends meet. Then we'll get educated about an uncomfortable subject. March is National Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, and our guest, a gastroenterologist from Danbury Hospital, is going to talk about what you can do to improve your digestive health, along with ways to reduce the risk of developing colorectal cancer. Then we'll visit with the founder of the Marin Sanchez Home Foundation and invite you to their second annual gala, A Magical Night in Havana. We're also going to chat about the ways the foundation is looking to empower young women to defend themselves against verbal and emotional manipulation and physical violence. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Voquette, right after this reminder. The area's largest college fair will be held Wednesday, April 4th from 4 to 8 at the Webster Bank Arena in Bridgeport. The fair will give high school students the opportunity to see over 200 colleges, universities, and gap year programs from throughout the country all in one day. The goal is to provide a community-wide event so area students can see and learn about colleges and the college selection process. In addition to the 200 colleges that will be on hand, the event also features speakers who are going to highlight some of the major considerations in the college selection process. Admission is free, and the event is open to the public. For more information about the Southern Connecticut College Fair, visit ctcollegefair.com. All right. Well, as you heard in the introduction, we're going to talk about ALICE with Annie. Annie is on the line with us. Annie Scully is a community outreach coordinator and analyst for United Way of Connecticut. And as you may have recalled, we've already done a couple of segments on ALICE, which is an acronym for Asset Limited, Income Constrained, and Employed. It is a initiative of the Connecticut United Way to define ALICE households, and I should say United Way, not just Connecticut, to identify households in ALICE situations and individuals who are challenged, and provide some initiatives and assistance to try to support them and help them. So first of all, the very first ALICE report came out in 2016, Annie, and I guess we're about 6 months away from a revised or updated version of that report, right?
Correct, John, and thanks for that great introduction. You're totally right that this is a United Way initiative, and actually in 2014 we put out our first report, mm-hmm. but our most recent report was released in October of 2016.
So it's going to be kind of like an every other year thing?
Exactly, yeah. We're sort of on an every 2 year schedule, and that has a lot to do with the great team of researchers that we work with through the National ALICE Project that are located in northern New Jersey. We're one of 16 states now that is part of this ALICE initiative, so excellent. They do a lot of number crunching, and we work closely with them to get some great data out every 2 years.
Well, for somebody who's an analyst, that's your cup of tea, I guess.
Absolutely.
Excellent. So the disturbing thing that I'm seeing right at the top here is that we could say virtually 4 out of every 10 people is in line at the drive-up, sitting beside us at church, at the soccer fields, in our own house party. 4 out of 10 are income constrained. 4 out of 10 people in Connecticut right now are ALICE.
You're absolutely right. And so what ALICE really does is it kind of paints a more accurate picture of people that struggle in Connecticut. So while only 11%, and I shouldn't say only, but while 11% of people are living below the federal income level, so they're literally in poverty in Connecticut, there's an additional 27% of households that struggle. And they struggle to meet their most basic needs. So we're not talking about, going on vacation or buying a new television. We're talking about affording, food for their children, about sending their kids to quality child care facilities or accredited centers, and just paying their monthly bills. So like you said, there's a large percentage of people in Connecticut that are having a hard time daily to just afford the bare bones budget.
And we're finding this across 169 towns, cities, and boroughs here in Connecticut.
Absolutely. Alice lives in every town and city in Connecticut. And we, even our more wealthy areas, we know that there's financial insecurity there, that there's people that really do need help.
So one of the things that has come out of this ALICE movement to date is a roadmap that United Way and the specialists who are working on this project have devised, right?
I'm assuming you're talking about this household survival budget.
Yes, and, yes. A roadmap to at least navigate through, if not out of ALICE.
For sure.
Tell us a little bit about that.
So yeah, so it's this household survival budget is really a tool that is used to assess financial hardship for ALICE. And what we've seen between 2014 and 16, and anticipate seeing between 2016 and 2018, is that it continues to be more difficult to afford just the basics in Connecticut, and that's true across the country. And despite this increase in the cost of living, wages aren't quite keeping up with that, which is what continues to strain a lot of hardworking families. One important thing to point out about ALICE is that, you know, employed is a defining characteristic. So despite working hard, there's a significant number of families and individuals that are struggling just to meet their basic needs. So this household survival budget in Connecticut consists of housing, childcare, food, transportation, health care, taxes, and then like a small pot of money for any kind of miscellaneous needs that might arise. But one thing that's definitely missing is savings. So we know that ALICE households are super vulnerable to any kind of financial shock. So a flat tire, a new set of brakes for their car, temporary unemployment can really derail these ALICE families around this tight budget.
Mm. And certainly, you know, you got to think about during a bad flu season like we're still experiencing here in Connecticut. A lot of folks, especially those with young kids and all the issues we've been seeing with young kids and the flu, they panic and maybe they have to go to a walk-in center, which is typically a high expense item that was unanticipated.
Absolutely. That's a great example. And not only is it, you know, a big out-of-pocket expense, but that could mean, you know, missing multiple days of work or keeping your kids, you know, home from daycare for multiple days or home from school for multiple days. And that's a big hit on families that are really, you know, living on a bare-bones budget and don't have a lot of money to spend outside of their basic needs.
Mm. So part of what has prompted us to give you a call, Annie, is the email that I got now about a week and a half ago or so about a new report that's kind of hit the streets about ALICE, which kind of both expands and deepens the look into the data that's been gathered so far. Tell us about this interim assertion into the program as we now are kind of looking down the road another 6 or 7 months to the 2018 ALICE update.
Absolutely. So you're totally correct. A few months ago, a new national report hit the pavement, and it's ALICE, the Consequences of Insufficient Income, Household Income. And it takes sort of using the ALICE data from 15 states that are currently involved in the ALICE initiative. It looks at really what it means, not only for those that are they're struggling financially, but for the communities they live in. When people are on this tight budget and they're facing daily obstacles, and the strategies they use to kind of navigate this limited budget. And it takes a look at, you know, what do ALICE households do when they can't afford basic housing, and what does an ALICE household do when they can't afford childcare, or when they can't afford to put enough nutritious food on their table? What do ALICE households do when they can't afford transportation? And then healthcare, what do ALICE families do when they're uninsured or underinsured and have to provide for their families and their children? So it's a new kind of way to look at our ALICE data. And one great thing about, I think, this ALICE project is it's more than just a data-driven exercise. It really invites a conversation, and it takes steps to sort of help ALICE find short and long-term solutions for their problems. So by sort of putting it in a perspective that people can understand and say, all right, day to day, what are these obstacles and how can we help owls to overcome these obstacles? And what are the consequences for those families when they're unable to do so? So this new report is fantastic.
So it sounds like above and beyond the household survival budget that's been out there for a while, this new report, which, by the way, you can download at alice.ctunitedway.org, gives kind of case studies from the front lines, if you will, that people can also use to develop either ideas or to kind of affirm and gain confidence in the moves that they're already making to try to conserve as much as possible and begin to move themselves, if not out of the Alice situation, at least toward a place where they might be able to enjoy a little bit of discretionary income and or savings.
That's absolutely correct, and it also really reinforces this concept and this idea that we depend on Alice, and when Alice struggles, we all struggle. Alice cares for our children, our aging parents, fixes our cars, and works in our local grocery stores, retail stores, and restaurants. So without Alice in our communities, we're really struggling. So supporting Alice and helping Alice to achieve financial security is in everyone's best interest.
Mm. And without Connecticut United Ways here in our state, we wouldn't know about Alice or have these great tools that are formulating or have been formulated to begin to address the issues that 4 out of 10 Connecticut households and individuals are facing. Tell us a little bit more about what Connecticut United Ways are doing, both with the data and information and experience they've now gained in the Alice Project since 2014, but also perhaps give us a look at how Connecticut United Ways may already be moving forward with the information inherent in this latest report.
Absolutely. So we're fortunate to work with our government and community partners to really promote the implementation of policies that can help Alice families achieve financial security. And we advocate for health, education, and financial security for all of Connecticut residents with a focus on good jobs, fair wages, access to good schools, affordable housing, and quality child care that families can afford. We also invest. A lot of our partners across the state and individuals donate to United Ways, which we're so grateful for, and via those donations, we're able to invest in child care, early learning, basic needs, diverse housing options, job training, asset development, and financial education to really help put Alice families on a path towards financial security. So we're currently, the legislative session is currently in session, and so if you, as you alluded to earlier, our alice.ctunitedway.org, you can download our 2018 policy agenda, which provide a little bit more detail about the different policies and initiatives that Connecticut United Ways support.
Mm-hmm. And we talked about not getting political, but from a strictly kind of clinical standpoint, in terms of the fact that we're in session right now in Hartford, are either Connecticut United Way leaders or individuals who work in agency partners throughout Connecticut already appearing or are planning to appear in front of the legislature to kind of use the ALICE acronym to help legislators become more familiar with the issue, as well as perhaps suggesting some ways that they can play a role in partnering with United Way at the state level to address some of these issues?
We absolutely hope so, and we're fortunate to work with great community partners, and we hope that this data can really paint a more accurate picture of the people in our communities across the state that do need help and that fall into this ALICE category where they might not be eligible for certain benefits because their income is too high, but then they're sort of in a catch-22 because they're not able to afford their basic needs. So, you know, what can we do to promote ALICE families to make sure that they are successful?
Yeah, like you said, so, the 27% who are not living below the poverty line, so they literally have it stamped on paper that they have eligibility for a number of assistance and support programs, but the others that, as you pointed out, or that we talked about, are a emergency room or walk-in clinic visit or a break job or a fender bender car accident or something away from having to make a decision decision between going to that walk-in clinic or fixing the brakes or maybe waiting a couple weeks before they could pay their rent or their mortgage or they have to forego some groceries. So all critically important information. And folks, if you do want to tune in and check out all of the information available on the ALICE initiative, once again, you can go to alice.ctunitedway.org. I want to thank our guest this morning, Annie Scully. She's a community outreach coordinator and analyst for United Ways of Connecticut. ALICE is asset limited, income constrained, and employed. If you are one of those 4 in 10 people, we hope you'll visit Connecticut's United Way website and take advantage of all of the resources that they are offering under the ALICE initiative and beyond to help support you here in Connecticut. So, Annie, thanks so much for being on the program, and we'll talk to you in the fall when the new 2018 ALICE update comes out. March is National Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, and my guest today is Dr. Joseph Fiorito. He is a Western Connecticut Medical Group gastroenterologist and fellow from the American College of Gastroenterology. He's also the section chief of the Department of Gastroenterology at Danbury Hospital, and today we're going to talk about what you can do to improve your digestive health and ways to reduce your risk of developing colorectal cancer, because here we are in March, Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, so it is not only appropriate, it's critically important, as we'll hear, because colorectal cancer is about the third highest mortality cancer that we're dealing with today. But first, let's meet Dr. Fiorito and talk a little bit about what we eat, Doctor. Good morning. Thanks for joining us. So Americans tend to eat a lot more simple carbs and processed food. We all know this. We hear about it all the time. It certainly affects our waistlines. But how does it impact our digestive system?
Thank you, John. It's great to be here, and I'm glad to share some of our thoughts about colorectal cancer today. It's a very important and significant topic. It's interesting, the cliche, you are what you eat, is probably quite true, and the more we look into what we're eating and how it affects our body and how it affects our digestive system, that statement is being borne out to be right on target. We certainly know that a diet rich in processed foods, saturated fats, simple sugars, can have deleterious effects on our body, and there are a number of points that go along with that. We have learned foods that are high in saturated fats are, in fact, associated with colon cancer. In fact, due to the accumulation of evidence that shows saturated fats and particularly processed meats are significantly related to colon cancer. The CDC has recently categorized processed meats such as cold cuts and bacon as a class 1 carcinogen, putting it in the same category as cigarette smoking due to the higher risk of colon cancer. We also know that the opposite is true, that diets that are rich in vegetables, fruits, fish, and lean meats are beneficial to our overall health. And a recently published study in the American Journal of Medicine shows that people on a DASH diet live longer, and those on a Mediterranean diet had much less heart disease. What that study also showed is that solid fats and added sugar intake were the two most significant factors that predicted an earlier mortality. As we continue to move forward and look into this more and more carefully, we are learning more and more about the microbiome, which is the bacterial milieu, the bacteria and viruses that live in our gastrointestinal tract and are part of who we are and how our health is dictated. And they are, in fact, an integral part of our bodies. The makeup of the bacteria in our GI systems is closely correlated with many diseases, including hypertension, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and in all likelihood, cancer as well. A poor diet, high in sugars and fats, alters the composition of this microbiome, these bacteria that live in our colon, in fact, may be associated with many of these diseases as the microbiome, the bacteria that live in our systems, alters to one that is not as beneficial.
Let me just ask you there. All of this that we've been hearing over the past roughly 8 to 10 years about the gut biology, the various enzymes and things going on in the intestine, is this impacted not only by the improper or less than optimal stuff that we're eating, but is it also impacted either in the quantity that we're eating or the times of day or when or how we're eating? In other words, is it not just about what we're eating, but it's also about we're better off sitting and having a meal in a relaxed atmosphere versus running through the drive-thru and maybe getting the healthiest chicken sandwich that you can from the drive-thru window, but then eating it on the run and washing it down with a coffee or even a water? I mean, does that added tension or speed of life as we're consuming the food we're eating also impact gut health?
Yes, I would agree with that totally. That many factors go into the health of our gastrointestinal system. We should all be paying much more attention and taking the time out of our busy days in order to sit down and eat properly and obtain the proper nutrition. Certainly the most important factor is what we're eating, as we just described. In addition, however, calories are extremely important. How much we're eating is critical. There are many studies that show the more we eat, the more difficult it is for our bodies to handle the excess in calories. Laying down fat across your waistband and your thighs, those relationships are correlated well with coronary disease, atherosclerotic disease, premature mortality, hypertension, diabetes, and so that's very important. In addition, there are very interesting studies about how people perform during the day at their jobs and whatever they do. And those who are the most productive and are the most efficient are those who take time out during their day, whether it's 15 minutes, 30 minutes, 45 minutes, to sit down, relax, eat slowly and properly, chew their food thoroughly. Not only does it help the gastrointestinal symptom, the system, but it also helps your mental attitude and your approach to the rest of the day. There is less fatigue toward the end of the day when meals are taken in proper quantity with the proper time given set aside to relax and eat, as well as the proper nutritional content.
So it's sounding to me like it, not just selecting the right food, the way in which we intake it and the mindfulness, if you will, of just stopping and eating not just the right thing, but taking the time to eat it is a really holistic benefit.
Yeah, for sure. And it is important for the entire body, mind, body, and everything that goes along with it.
So that would lead me to wonder then, and I have to assume that both the improper content of what we're eating and the way we may be improperly eating it isn't just a cause for colorectal cancer. I imagine there are many other very negative health byproducts to that, both the quantity and the quality of how we intake what we're eating.
Yes, many diseases are, in fact, associated with our dietary intake and how we go about it. And once again, we're talking about hypertension, diabetes, coronary disease, malignancies, and many, many more. And it goes far beyond that. I mean, I truly believe that we should be looking at labels and reading labels and not quite counting calories, but certainly paying very clear attention to portion size. And I would also caution that in order to maintain weight and proper balance, be very careful about how you go about it. Fad diets tend to do poorly and tend to backfire and wind up gaining more weight than less weight. Sugar substitutes tend not to be very good for you. You know, there are some recent studies that show people who are using sugar substitutes actually don't lose weight and may wind up gaining weight. And many of these sugar substitutes, even though they are branded as natural products, wreak havoc on the gastrointestinal tract with gas and flatulence and cramps and bloating. And once again, in control trials, do not show that weight loss is a factor that these are achieving. Most important, perhaps, is that the sugar substitutes are altering the microbiome and changing from the good bacteria that we have in our gastrointestinal tract naturally to a less favorable group of bacteria that can lead to these gastrointestinal symptoms.
Very good. Folks, we're about halfway through our interview right now with Dr. Joseph Fiorito. He is with the Department of Gastroenterology at Danbury Hospital. He has a myriad of qualifications to be talking to us here during March, Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month. We're going to come back after a brief break to talk more about colorectal cancer, risk factors, preventative measures, symptoms, and how it's treated. Stick with us.
Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on a Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. Love CT also has funds to donate to a local charity. If you're part of or know of an organization in Connecticut that would like to be a beneficiary of the Love CT Fund, submit your request at lovect.org. Look for Love CT all over Connecticut and get involved. Love CT is powered by Allied Building Products, Planet Fitness, and Chip's Family Restaurant. Learn more and apply for the fund now at lovect.org. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. For 10 years, the colorful hats and festive spirit of Ron's Run for the Roses annual Kentucky Derby Day Gala has been the signature event of the Ron Foley Foundation, a grassroots organization that's raised a little over $1.8 million for pancreatic cancer medical research and education, as well as to support pancreatic cancer patients throughout the tri-state area, including about 700 Connecticut residents who'll be diagnosed with pancreatic cancer in 2018. This year's fundraiser is going to take place on Saturday, May 5th, beginning at 2:30 at Folly Farm in Simsbury. Attendees will enjoy entertainment, live and silent auctions, and watch the running of the 144th Kentucky Derby live on a big screen. For more information about Ron's Run, visit ronsrun.org.
We are back here at Danbury Hospital, and pleased to be continuing our conversation with Dr. Joseph Fiorito. March is National Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, and Dr. Fiorito is here at the Danbury Hospital. He's with the Western Connecticut Medical Group and a fellow of the American College of Gastroenterology. Dr. Fiorito, colorectal anything is an uncomfortable region for most folks to be talking about, but they've dedicated a whole month to becoming more aware of its dangers because it's pretty prevalent. It's in the top five, if not in the top three, of killers.
Yeah, so in fact, colorectal cancer is the third most common cancer in the United States and is the second leading cause of cancer death. Besides lung cancer. That's the bad news. The good news is that it is preventable with proper screening procedures. If everyone age 50 and older were screened regularly, we can prevent 6 out of 10 and perhaps more than that deaths from colorectal cancer each year. Most colorectal cancer begins in a small polyp or growth that occurs on the lining of the gastrointestinal tract in your rectum or colon. And that's why colonoscopies are so effective. They can be recognized and removed. And once they are removed, then the risk of getting colon cancer, at least from that polyp, is eliminated. Now, we don't do colonoscopy because we want to find the colon cancer. So many people are afraid, what are you going to find? No, that's not the issue. We're doing colonoscopy to find the polyps that could become colon cancer and remove them and prevent colon cancer. Mm. So this is a key point. We're not looking for something bad. We're looking to prevent something bad from occurring. So the point and the what I want to stress mostly throughout this this interview is that colon cancer is common. It affects all of us, men and women, but it is preventable simply by obtaining a screening procedure.
So let me ask you then, we've heard a lot about in commercials and read about things like called a virtual colonoscopy or other types of imaging or examinations that that may not entail the uncomfortable 48 hours before, during, and after a colonoscopy. Tell us a little bit about that.
So we recommend colonoscopy as the preferred method for colorectal cancer screening. The reason for that, it is that it is the only truly preventive test that evaluates the entire colon. We find the polyp, we remove it, and the risk from that polyp is gone. However, there are many people who either are unable or unwilling to have a colonoscopy for various reasons. Whether it be the preparation, although the preparations are getting better and better, there are many alternatives to the large gallon of liquid that we have people drinking. And so that is certainly should not be a deterrent. Ask your physician what alternatives there are for preparation, please. But having said that, the true mantra is the best screening test is whatever one you will get. So if there is an absolute refusal to undertake colonoscopy, then there are other choices. There is a fecal occult blood test called FIT, fecal immunochemical testing. And that's just simply putting a dab of stool on a card and checking if there is blood. There's Cologuard, which many people have heard of now, testing the fecal DNA. And so that is also an alternative. These tests, testing the stool, are reliable, but they do need to be done frequently. The FIT test is every year. The Cologuard right now is every 3 years and being evaluated. Again, if it's positive, that means a colonoscopy. These tests are fairly good, 70% plus, 80% plus, even 90% for Cologuard for identifying the potential for colon cancer there, but they don't pick up the precancerous polyps very well. Mm. And so this is an issue and one of the reasons why we continue to recommend colonoscopy as the primary screening test. There's also CT colonoscopy, which is virtual colonoscopy, which means that you're getting a CAT scan that evaluates the colon for polyps. This still requires a preparation. It requires the scan being done. There are some amount of radiation that's undertaken, and if it's positive again, you need to have a colonoscopy. Mm. An interesting test that is coming and being refined is what's called a liquid biopsy, a blood test that looks at a number of markers in the blood to see who might have colon cancer in people at risk. That's not quite here yet, but the data is starting to accumulate, and that'll be an interesting test that we're all looking forward to see.
But the bottom line is when symptoms present, whether it's bleeding or some extreme lower GI discomfort or issues, the cancer, in a sense, is already progressing. It's very hard to detect it without the colonoscopy or perhaps one of the alternative options that will then trigger a colonoscopy.
Yes, that's a very, very important point. Screening tests mean there are no symptoms. We want to find these polyps, remove them before they become a cancer, and if we find cancers, we want to find them early, when surgery is the cure and there's no need for any additional therapy. The earlier we find cancers, the better the survival and the better the outcome for the patient. Mm-hmm. However, if symptoms do arise, they should be brought to the attention of the physician immediately. So what are the symptoms of colon cancer? We look for a change in bowel habits, a change from normal to diarrhea or constipation. We look for rectal bleeding for sure. Any type of bleeding is very significant. Persistent abdominal pain such as cramps or gas, a feeling that your bowel is not emptying completely. Even unexplained weight loss or fatigue can be a sign of anemia that can be due to a colon cancer. These should all be brought to the attention of your physician early on before they progress. One very important point in this regard is that, unfortunately, we have been seeing in recent years an increase in colorectal cancer in the younger population, as low as late 20s and early 30s up to 50. And no longer should rectal bleeding or abdominal symptoms be ignored in younger people, because they are at risk as well as we see this, as we see the incidence of colon cancer continuing to rise in this group. It's interesting, that may be related to the changes in our diet and the microbiome that we talked about before. Mm-hmm. In any event, the take-home message today for those who are 50 and older who need to be screened and the younger is to get your screening test. Who is at risk? The people at risk are age 50. If there's a family history of colon cancer or colon polyps, if there are pre-existing conditions like inflammatory bowel disease, ulcerative colitis, or Crohn's disease, if a family member has colon cancer or a history of ovarian, endometrial, or stomach cancer. In addition, African Americans and people of Hispanic descent may be at higher risk and perhaps should be screened at 45 or younger. So, again, for more information about gastrointestinal health, if you're thinking about getting screening for colonoscopy, you can visit our website at www.wchn.org or call our office at 203-739-7038.
Very important information this month, March, Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month. And thanks to our guest, Dr. Joseph Fiorito, we're very much more aware of some very important and extremely topical information in regards to this, one of the most dangerous and deadly forms of cancer, as we heard, affecting people much younger than 50 these days. So please take the doctor's advice, and we're glad to be able to bring it to you. Dr. Fiorito, thank you so much for meeting with us.
Thank you.
Well, I'm always pleased to make a new acquaintance here on the award-winning For the People, but the voice we're going to hear, Donna Cimarelli, has been familiar to a lot of listeners on a number of our radio stations. She is the founder of the Marin Sanchez Home Foundation and the mother of the late Marin Sanchez. Donna, first and foremost, so sorry for your loss. It's incredible the amount of good you've been able to do in your daughter's name in such a short time. But let's take you back to not the incident that caused us to lose Marin, but to the aftermath and how you started to see a path toward doing good for so many other young women.
Well, okay, thank you. Well, thank you for having me here this morning. Let's see. what I could say to you is that Marin was an incredible human being, and she unfortunately lost her life, like many young women do, to a situation where basically someone just could not accept the word no. And I decided early on that I would like to create a foundation where I can raise awareness for young girls and teach them that it's okay to say no and how to say no and to listen to their intuition and follow their gut instincts when they feel like something might be of danger to them instead of always being the one that needs to be nice. I think that young women need to create a balance in their life and not always be the one that is solving the problems, but the one that is taking care of themselves. And Marin fell into a situation where she felt sorry for someone who was having troubles. And when those troubles became too big for her to handle, she backed away and unfortunately lost her life. So we want to teach young women about emotional and psychological manipulation. And we do that in a number of ways, but the main reason and the main way we do it is through our her self-awareness workshop, where we do a two-hour workshop teaching young women all of the signs of manipulation, how it could make you feel, and what you can do to prevent it from happening to you and carrying on a long relationship with something or someone that's unhealthy.
Very good.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about the journey toward not only trying to accomplish this in Marin's name, but how you went about researching and making the acquaintances with the experts that helped you get to where you are today.
Well, a woman named Lana came very early on to a circle of my friends. She is a film director and a website designer, and she volunteered her services free to me from the first day Marin passed up until today. I did not take her up on the offer early because, as you could imagine, I had a lot of healing time that had to happen first before I could do anything for anyone else. But when the time came, I worked very closely with her to do a website and our brochure and to move my vision forward. And she introduced me to a great guy, Dr. David Bernstein, and he is a threat assessment specialist. And he sat with me and we talked for many hours about, you know, the dangers of young people and the signs and warning signs of youth that may be going through difficult times and could be a threat to someone else's life. And he introduced me to the book called The Gift of Fear. And the author of that is Gavin DeBecker. And Gavin DeBecker is also a threat assessment specialist who works with high-profile clients, movie stars, politicians, things like that. And he goes into companies when there is a problem person, and he assesses them. And then he comes back and says, you know, this person is really not a threat, or this person potentially could blow up the office. And so with that knowledge and talking to people like that, I was able to understand really why and how people could become so disturbed that they would want to hurt someone else. And so I received a lot of knowledge from Dr. Bernstein and the book. And we had a lot of focus groups with young women, just asking them questions, you know, in all different areas, and got some ideas from them and really let the kids teach us how to teach them. So we're still a little new at it, but we are really moving forward and grabbing the attention of the young kids because they really, I feel like they think in this time that it's just not going to school anymore or it's not just going to the movie theater anymore. There's a sense of urgency in protecting themselves from what we see on TV. And I think that the more knowledge we can give them about taking care of themselves and following their instincts, is just going to create a better atmosphere and potential world, you know, potentially a better world.
Hmm. Well, how many of these self-awareness workshops have you done so far?
So we were invited to Trumbull High School in Connecticut, and we spoke with the senior class. They actually made it mandatory for them to come listen to our talk. Yeah. I work together with a psychologist. Her name is Lauren Goldstein, and we helped each other put a presentation together, a PowerPoint presentation. So we spoke to every senior class in Trumbull High School a few months ago, and then I was personally invited to the University of Bridgeport, where I spoke a few weeks ago, and I'm invited back for next month. I'm very excited about that, and we are also branching out into Fairfield County. So I was able to be invited to Norwalk High School to teach, to talk to the health class there as well. Mm. So, you know, we're doing a little bit everywhere, and hopefully my goal is that I'll be able to speak to, you know, maybe an auditorium of kids all at one time, maybe at the end of the year or the beginning of the year when they start maybe college, you know, when they're going out into the world and, you know, they've never really been doing it alone. I think the knowledge that we have to give them could help them to feel safer and potentially maybe even stay safer.
In the couple of sessions that you've already done, it interested me that you mentioned that you sort of let the kids help kind of teach and inform the programming. Can you talk a little bit about the conceptions that you had about where you thought the programming needed to go when you walked through the door versus a couple of things that the young participants in these workshops may have imparted on you that were either surprising or caught you off guard or were, I would say, pleasantly surprising in that they may have suggested things that you didn't think of?
Yeah, well, first of all, it's a very emotional workshop because we begin the workshop with a news clip of the morning that Marin was killed. And it's a long clip. And it actually shows Marin next door to the school at the pizza place on video the day before she passes. So it really grabs the kids when we do that. And I do that for a reason. I do that because I want them to understand that they are not infallible, that this could happen to anyone. And it always seems like it could happen to somebody else until it happens in your school, in your neighborhood, in your family. So that's how we begin it, and we really do grab them. And my surprise was we were invited to the Marriott in Waterbury last month to speak to an organization called Girls Inc.
Sure.
And we did a few sessions with them, and I've got to tell you, John, I could cry telling you. At the end of us talking, I had a line of girls that were all crying. And I was like, uh-oh, I don't know if I was prepared for this. But I mean, we were talking to some girls whose friends were killed because of the same reason, Marin. And, you know, or some girls who have experienced stalking or who have experienced frightening situations with their partners or their boyfriends or even their friends.
Yeah.
And this is something we don't talk about.
Yeah, sort of there before the grace of God go I, huh?
Exactly, yeah, and we don't teach our young girls what it means to feel manipulated and how do you get out of it. And it's a very frightening situation for a young girl who doesn't have experience in life. For, I want to say a boy, but it could be a girl, for someone to manipulate them to do things that they know aren't right or that doesn't feel good to them, but they do it anyway because they don't want to ruffle feathers.
Yeah.
And I think especially in this time with the Me Too movement, I think girls are starting to find their voice, and I think that people are really, really rising up to the occasion for these young women because they need to have a voice and they need to be heard.
Very good. We're about halfway through our chat with Donna Cimarelli here on the award-winning For the People. She's the founder of the Marin Sanchez Home Foundation, along with, as we're hearing, lots of support, not only from experts, but from folks who come to the sessions that her foundation is hosting, both to honor and to remember Marin Sanchez, the late Marin Sanchez, who was lost to intimate partner violence. the mission of the Marin Sanchez Home Foundation is to empower girls to defend themselves against emotional, psychological, and verbal manipulation and physical violence. If you'd like to learn more, we'd like you to go to marinsanchezhomefoundation.org and check them out. We're also going to be talking in just a couple minutes about ways you can be a sponsor or donor to their upcoming gala, which is happening near the end of April. It's called A Magical Night in Havana. And we'd like to line up a number of organizations to get behind that event. But first, let's go back and chat with Donna just a few more minutes about the great work that she's been able to do to honor her daughter in the short time since we lost Marin. So, Donna, the first segment of this was about the self-awareness workshops. But then comes the actual moment where the rubber hits the road, where no doesn't cut it. And these individual young women may find themselves in a situation where they actually have to defend themselves. You give them assistance in that respect as well.
Yeah, so we have a program called the Her Self-Defense Program. And that began about a year ago now. And it's a two-hour course. It includes learning life-saving techniques, practice sessions for the girls to gain confidence. We're hoping it will equip young women with the tools they'll need to defend themselves. And we have some fantastic instructors. One that I'm so proud to say is on board with us is MMA champion Nick Newell. He actually graduated from Jonathan Law High School, where Marin went. And he has a gym called the Fighting Arts Academy. And he just won in Texas his last fight. And he has really been quite an inspiration to me. Nick was born with one arm. And he, I mean, is just an incredible fighter with the odds against him. And he took on the mission of the Her Self-Defense course very early on. And we have one coming up on March 25th at his academy. And we usually fill the room with at least 30 to 35 girls. And a lot of them also come with their moms, which is really great for me to see. So we're branching out into Fairfield County with another instructor, Sally Coudeau. And we're just hoping that we could bring this to a lot of different schools. We were invited to UConn last year, and we taught about 150 of the sorority sisters up there. And the girls on campus are really asking us to come, because they are very, they're worried about what's happening on campus, because a lot of things that are happening on campus are covered up, and the girls are really not as safe as people think they are on college campuses. So we've been invited to the University of New Haven, and I think it's just going to keep on going, because girls are really looking to be equipped and empowered with the tools that they need to just be confident and independent and be able to take care of themselves.
The other critically important component to the work that you're doing, Donna, is now the expansion of the program further to begin addressing bystander involvement. This is something that we've been seeing for about a little over a decade as a movement that has really begun to make a difference in the world of bullying, especially with younger people, because there's strength in numbers. And when numbers stand against a bully or someone who has an intent to do harm, it tends to de-escalate the situation, and it ends up better for not only the bystanders, but also the intended victim. And oftentimes the bully learns a lesson and may turn a corner as well. Let's talk just for a couple moments about the component that tries to empower bystanders.
So what we do is we do a timeline of Marin. And that, again, is extremely emotional. A timeline of when Marin sort of became friends with this boy. What were the pre-incident indicators that were happening in her life that people saw, that I felt, that she felt, but we, of course, would never imagine in a million years that would escalate to a murder. So we use her timeline of when things started going wrong. And then I speak to the kids about Marin's friends. Excuse me. It really is emotional, because I'm friends with a lot of her friends that, you know, spent a lot of time at my house.
Yeah.
And very shortly after the event, the tragedy, you know, I started hearing and finding out things from them that were so disturbing. And I said, wow, these kids have to live with this for the rest of their life. Mm-hmm. And they grew up, what, they're 16 years old. Their brain isn't even developed. And they were smacked with this horrific tragedy where some of them heard things and saw things that they knew were not right. But we don't teach them where to go. We don't tell them what they should do. We don't tell them, listen, if you hear this, this is off. This is not right. You have got to go report this. So these kids heard and saw things and never said anything. And now they have to just live the rest of their life thinking, how about if I had said something? Mm-hmm. So for me, it's really important to get the message to these kids that nothing is too small. If it doesn't sit right in your heart and in your gut, you have to say something because you can save lives. And so that's part of where we go with that part of the workshop.
So in order to be able to bring this impactive level of support, training, and information to more young women across Connecticut and even beyond on behalf of the Marin Sanchez Home Foundation, it takes support. And while the upcoming gala at the end of April is nearly, if not sold out, there is a lot of need for sponsor support. So before we let you go, Donna, just let folks know where they can get in touch with you in the event they want to. They've heard something that you've said today that has moved them to become a sponsor, a patron, or supporter of this upcoming gala, which is called A Magical Night in Havana, coming up on April 28th.
Yes, so it's called Magical Night in Havana because Marin was Cuban and she was very proud of it. So we decided to go after her Cuban roots this year and really celebrate. I could be reached at info@marinsanchezhomefoundation.org. And we also have an address if anyone would like to send anything. It's 167 Cherry Street, Unit 126, Milford, Connecticut. And also my private phone, which I take all phone calls from anybody, is 203-331-6180. And with our gala, we're really looking for sponsorship or donations of gift certificates for a very special thing we're doing with Cuban mystery boxes this year. Mm-hmm. We're selling them and putting gifts inside of them. So any restaurants or, you know, any service place that would love to send us a gift certificate, and we would also send them a letter back for tax purposes.
Excellent. The Marin Sanchez Home Foundation, empowering young women across Connecticut and beyond to defend themselves against verbal and emotional manipulation and physical violence, all happening to honor and to remember Marin Sanchez. Her mom is Donna Cimarelli. She is the founder and CEO of the Marin Sanchez Home Foundation. That is their website, marinsanchezhomefoundation.org. Go there to learn more. Maybe bring the Marin Sanchez Home Foundation efforts into your school, your community, your college. It's all available there for you. And Donna, once again, we are so terribly sorry for your loss, but so proud to be here to try to support you in the great work that you're doing that's certainly going to make a difference in the lives of so many others. So thank you so much for being on the program.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host and do not necessarily represent the views of Connoisseur Media. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a community calendar item relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make a request for consideration in writing via email to me at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be viewed upon request weekdays during normal business hours in the New Haven area at 440 Wheelers Farms Road in Milford, and for our Hartford stations at 869 Blue
Blue Hills Avenue in Bloomfield. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. This is John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. Don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab at our radio station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.